Welcome to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.
A distillery in Indiana making gin using spices that came anywhere from Israel to a few islands in Indonesia, processed in New York.
Lior Lev Sarkars sources spices from all over the world and then sells them to chefs, home cooks, and local distilleries. He'll tell us what to think about freshness when it comes to spices. From Harvest Public Media, we'll meet Nebraska landowners who are worried that the Keystone XL pipeline would threaten the water supply their farm depends on. And for our food today, Chef Daniel Orr uses rabbit to make a stew and a salad. News. What's up, Mark?
From our reporters this week, amid growing concern about possible immigration raids on farms, the American Dairy Coalition is floating a new program that would allow states to sponsor their own foreign workers. A statement on the ADC's website blasts the federal government's handling of immigration issues, saying Washington has, quote, consistently shown itself incapable of predicting the labor needs of the states, and states have more local knowledge of the types of workers and immigrants that they need, unquote. The plan would allow states to sponsor immigrants in the same way employers do now. The ADC proposal would give each state 2,500 visas and a share of a pool of 125,000 visas. A 2015 study by Texas A&M University researchers, funded by the industry group National Milk Producers Federation, said that eliminating migrant labor would reduce U.S. milk production by 48.4 billion pounds, shut down thousands of farms, and result in a loss of more than 200,000 jobs. The archipelago nation of Vanuatu is planning to ban imported food at government events and tourist spots in one of its provinces to help curb rising obesity. A 2014 World Health Organization report found that 28% of the country's 250,000 residents suffer from obesity. A shift from traditional diets to imported junk foods over the last few decades is driving obesity rates higher. The World Trade Organization could penalize Vanuatu for the ban. In 2007, Samoa banned imports of turkey tails, a popular high-fat snack in many Pacific nations. But the ban was lifted in 2011 because banning imports of one or two foods violates WTO rules. Pacific Island nations have some of the highest obesity rates in the world. Many of those countries, including Vanuatu, have already imposed taxes on sugary drinks. And the Food Marketing Institute and the Grocery Manufacturers Association, two of the food industry's largest trade groups, issued new recommendations to retailers and food makers to modernize their labeling systems. It would narrow their label language to just two phrases: best if used by, to tell consumers that the food is still okay to eat after the date, but freshness matters, so eat it quickly, and use by, to tell shoppers that the food has a shelf life and should be eaten before the date on the package. Due to a lack of federal standards, a bevy of food expiry labels have cropped up over the years, each manufacturer using different language to tell consumers that their product is freshest before a certain date. On a trip to the grocery store, consumers will see everything from expires on labels on eggs to sell by labels on peanut butter. Some counts put the number of different date labels at a dozen or more. Food waste has become a signature issue for some environmental groups, who see the issue as a way to tackle both hunger and climate change in one fell swoop. You can start seeing more standardized food labels by summer 2018. The recommendations, though, are voluntary. EarthEats.org is the place where we post these stories. Also, check out a video on our website that shows how scientists are working to differentiate harmless strains of E. coli from the potential deadly strains.
Articles and videos from our reporters, yes. Mark Chilla, thanks to you.
Cool. See you next week.
President Donald Trump gave new momentum to the controversial Keystone XL pipeline when he took office. But the final say on whether the pipeline is built may lie in the Midwest. Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach reports on landowners in a rural part of Nebraska who promised to put a kink in the president's plans.
Jeanne Crumley's introduction to the Keystone XL oil pipeline came 7 years ago. That's when she learned heavy crude from Canada, up to 35 million gallons per day, could soon pass through her land. In fact, the pipeline route isn't far from her kitchen where we sat to talk.
The pipeline would be about, 400 yards north of my house, running through a creek out here where cattle water and where we draw irrigation water.
Crumley's family raises cattle and corn in Holt County in north-central Nebraska. They draw water for thirsty crops and livestock from the High Plains Aquifer. She calls the underground reservoir the lifeblood of the operation. Keystone XL would run through the land above that water supply. The company in charge of the project, TransCanada, says pipelines are safer than hauling oil by train, and it says it will accept the legal responsibility to clean up any damage. But for Jeanne Crumley, an oil leak on her land is something she can't afford.
For our agricultural purposes, the purity of the water is essential, and it's the thing that probably is driving the resistance.
She and a group of other local landowners sued to block TransCanada from seizing land by eminent domain. And in 2015, it looked like that resistance had paid off when the Obama White House rejected Keystone XL.
It was a sweet victory, but I'm a realist, too. I knew it was a victory, but I didn't believe that the battle was over.
We'll see if we can get that pipeline built. A lot of jobs, 28,000 jobs. Great construction jobs.
4 days after his inauguration, President Donald Trump revived the project. At a signing ceremony in the Oval Office, he issued an executive order directing the State Department to approve the pipeline. Now, Crumley and dozens of like-minded landowners in this farming and ranching community are reviving their resistance. They gathered at the community center in the Holt County seat of O'Neill to hear from allies like Jane Klebb of the anti-pipeline group Bold Alliance.
We certainly don't have somebody in the White House right now that we feel like we can influence a lot, but we think we can stop it here in the state.
Keystone XL could be approved at the federal level by the end of March, but Klebb says TransCanada still must have two things from Nebraska, a route approved by the state's Public Service Commission, and contracts with all landowners, either voluntarily or through eminent domain. Sarah Shore of the climate change activism group 350.org, which opposes the pipeline, says there will be other stall tactics, federal lawsuits, and legal complaints by tribes in South Dakota. But these Nebraska landowners could be an important obstacle.
Keystone XL can't be built without eminent domain. Even after that, landowners are planning further legal challenges. If we stop the route through Nebraska, we stop the pipeline.
The pipeline does have supporters in Nebraska. Governor Pete Ricketts has touted the potential construction jobs and tax revenue. And there are supporters in Holt County for the same reasons. Bill Tilkey has heard from them. He chairs the County Board of Supervisors. They passed a resolution against Keystone XL. But Tilkey was surprised. A lot of people were upset because they want the pipeline.
I had probably more calls with people wondering why we had done the resolution than I ever did on people calling to say to do that.
Politically speaking, Holt County is deep red. Voters went for Donald Trump 8-1 over Hillary Clinton. But at the local level, Keystone XL doesn't break along party lines the way it does nationally.
We have to live in the community with our neighbors. We go to church with our neighbors. So we get along, but at a superficial level.
Landowner Jeanne Crumley says the pipeline is like the elephant in the room. Both supporters and opponents are entrenched in their views, but they rarely discuss it publicly.
The rules of the game now are you don't talk about something controversial.
Now Keystone XL is back in the open, and Crumley hopes it'll get people talking, even if they don't agree, because this part of rural Nebraska will have a lot to say about the pipeline's fate. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
And a bit later today, we visit Fort Morgan, Colorado. We hear how it's coming to terms with rapid cultural change. I had my coffee in hand that morning as I opened up Skype for the interview with a person Bon Appetit has called a spice wizard.
My name is Lior Lev-Sarkars, and I'm the owner of La Boite Biscuit and Spices in New York City.
He's also the author of The Spice Companion, a hefty tome that illustrates the flavor profiles and uses for 102 different spices. I spoke with him ahead of his visit to Cardinal Spirits in Bloomington, Indiana, for a series of classes and events. It's important to know how he defines spice before we get started. His is a broad definition that includes anything dry that you can season your food with. So that includes herbs, sure, but also grains and barks and berries and even dehydrated cheese. But back to my coffee. I flipped to the green cardamom section in the Spice Companion and saw that that's a good addition to coffee and a pretty traditional Arabic preparation, he added.
I think it also adds a certain element of sweetness and fruitiness to the coffee. Thus, the need to add less sugar or not add any sugar at all. You know, we don't often think about flavoring our coffee aside from sugar or other sweeteners. And I think this is one way of just making your coffee a bit more interesting and flavorful.
Sarkars lived in Israel and then expanded his culinary career in South America and then in France, and then was on to cook in restaurants in New York. He decided to focus his craft on spices in 2006 when he opened La Boite. A couple years ago, he partnered with Cardinal Spirits in Indiana to come up with a spice blend for their Terra gin. One of his special touches in the spice blend was Zuta, a wild, prolific mint that grows on his father's olive grove in Israel's Upper Galilee.
I think the beauty of this project is showcasing how the world is one small, tiny place. It's a distillery in Indiana making gin using spices that came anywhere from Israel to a few islands in Indonesia, processed in New York.
Sarkars wants to show chefs and home cooks alike that they should be using more spices more often, better quality spices, and you should be doing it year-round. He says it doesn't matter where you live. The idea of fresh and of local are very different for spices. Take the two most ubiquitous spices.
Most of us have accepted or embraced the fact that we have a salt shaker and a pepper grinder in our kitchen because we realize that they're essential to season our food. However, very few people live near a salt harvest facility or a pepper farm. And so they grow in other countries that are usually far away from you. The good thing about spices is that they're actually better when they are dried, you know. So in order to use a peppercorn, for the most part, you first need to dry it and wash it and store it. In some cases, like vanilla, you even have to age it for a while before they're ready to be used. So talking about fresh is just a bit different than lettuce or fish or meat.
When you're shopping for spices at the grocery store, Sarkars suggests looking for as much description as possible. Keep an eye out for a best before label on spice jars. The Spice Companion is not a cookbook. It describes where the 102 different spices originate, how they're grown, and what they taste like. There are beautiful pictures of everything, too. It also lists some traditional recipes and some maybe not so traditional recipes that you could try with the various spices. I flipped to the pages about Sichuan pepper.
For kids, or for those who remember what it is being a kid, and I might had a weird childhood, when you play with batteries and you sometimes try to put them in your mouth and you get that kind of numbness or alkaline flavor, I think that's one way of describing it. They have a sort of a zinc numbness flavor to them. I know it doesn't sound very tasty and appealing, but it actually is, you know, and I think the beauty of Sichuan, aside from their floral notes when you smell them, if it's a good quality Sichuan, the real nice floral sweet notes, once you eat something with them, you are able to experience flavors that you have never before because they do numb part of your mouth and your tongue. So other flavors do shine through.
Do not try that battery thing at home. Instead, you could make our pickled okra that includes Sichuan peppercorns. He suggests putting it on fish or maybe with a spinach salad. I suggested a breaded pork tenderloin with Sichuan. He was all about that. Basically, try it, see what you like. Lior Lev Sarkars' business is La Boite. He'll be sending a couple reporters to his spice camp next week. So keep an eye on eartheats.org for more tips from the spice wizard himself. Coming up today, our recipes featuring rabbit. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From vegetarian to paleo and low carb. Taste matters. Your taste. Current truck location is available at whereisurgent.com. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses, located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net. I'm Annie, and you're with Earth Eats. We thought we'd cook with rabbit today, maybe a meat you're not familiar with. Daniel, though, has this way of combining out-of-the-ordinary ingredients with familiar flavors or in a good old-fashioned preparation to make them seem not so intimidating. So he'll make a stew and then some bright and spicy Thai flavors to mix into a rabbit salad.
When you have a sudden guest or you're in an awful hurry, may I say, here's a way to make a rabbit stew in no time.
When you buy rabbit, you normally get the whole rabbit. It's probably about a foot long. It's got some really nice muscular hind legs. And then you have some smaller little legs up front, which I call rabbit wings. And then in the center is the loin. So that's the long, narrow body. And there's some really nice meat along the two sides of the backbones, which is probably the most prized meat. If you would go to a fancy restaurant, that would be the part they would sell. They would probably debone it and then, you know, stuff it with some wild mushrooms and foie gras, and then wrap it up in some bacon or caul fat, roast it off, and then slice it, and you have a beautiful kind of marble-looking presentation. And then what you want to do is to always make the most use out of your carcass. You can make a stock just like you would make a chicken stock. Just cut it up, roast it, top it with some water, some of those nice root vegetables, chop those up, and then boil it for about 3 hours. And you'll have a nice rabbit stock that you can make into a, you know, a soup, just like you would do a chicken soup. All right, so we're going to get started on our rabbit stew. So we're going to play off using that real lean meat to create a really nice lean dish. What we're going to do is season the rabbit, a little bit of kosher salt and some of our fresh ground pepper. We always use fresh ground pepper at Earth Eats. Put a little bit of olive oil on top and kind of massage that into the meat. Add just a pinch of cayenne, as well as some rosemary, and a little bit of fresh thyme. The rosemary has that kind of piney aroma. It's great with tomatoes. Thyme is a really nice kind of earthy, citrusy flavor. And then, of course, we love our garlic at Earth Eats. Okay, a little bit of oil in the pan. We've got a nice preheated pan. And I'm going to add the rabbit. One rabbit will feed about 4 people. Okay, we're just going to let that really brown and kind of caramelize on that first side and then turn them over. And you do this whenever you're making any kind of stew. You brown the meat first and that intensifies the flavor. It seals in some of the moisture of the meat and it will give your liquid that you add to it a lot more flavor than if you just were to put it over raw rabbit. Then we're going to add our onions. Okay, as those sweat, which is the culinary term for cooking down and becoming tender, we're gonna add a little more rosemary and thyme. We just made a little sachet or bundle of thyme. We'll add that. Okay, we're going to deglaze with some white wine. I'm gonna add a little sweetness by adding a touch of honey. I've got some whole peeled tomatoes. I'm just going to coarsely break them up with my hands. And be careful because they will squirt up on you, and don't wear your best white blouse or...
He says to the woman holding the microphone wearing a white shirt.
I've done it enough times. I cook in white every day, so...
That's true.
going to add a little bit of salt and pepper, and then we're going to cover it and let it simmer for minimum 45 minutes, but it's even better after about an hour, hour and a half.
While that was cooking, Daniel whipped up a salad. He steamed the rabbit ahead of time, pulled the meat off the bones, and shredded it. For the marinade, he collected some Thai-flavored ingredients like peanut butter and one little pepper.
Oh, you got a little Scotch bonnet, which is a nice spicy pepper there.
It's like on a spice factor, let's say 1 to 10. 10 will, you know, burn your head off. Where is that?
That's about 11.
Awesome.
Okay, for our marinade, we have cider vinegar. We have a little Thai fish sauce. Some Chinese black vinegar. And you can find both the Thai fish sauce and the Chinese black vinegar at your local Asian market or international market, and at most high-end food stores. Add a little bit of soy sauce, some chopped ginger, a little bit of red pepper flakes. Again, we're going to balance that out with a little bit of sugar, which the Thai love to mix a little bit of sugar with the hot, spicy flavors. Peanut butter is going to give us some thickness. And you can make a big batch of this dressing and keep it in the fridge and, you know, use it on all kinds of things. You could use it on nice, mild fish or chicken or rabbit, like we're doing today. Very creamy and rich. All right, I'm going to spoon some of this on the rabbit. All right, so to finish it, we're going to make the salad part. I've got some pineapple and some carrots and some romaine lettuce. Now with the mint, I like to leave it in nice big pieces so you get kind of punchy flavors of the mint that will cool down the spiciness of the chilies that we added to that. You know, a lot of these cuisines that come from countries that border the equator, they love the spicy food because it cools them down, actually. It puts beads of sweat on your brow, so when the breeze comes through, it actually cools you down.
He wanted to emphasize that you can control the level of spice in this dish. Sub out a milder, more floral pepper, or go for the gold and get yourself a ghost pepper if you really want. You'll see the recipe on eartheats.org. Just use it as a jumping off point. Another story from Harvest today. Illegal immigration, refugee resettlement, the lagging rural economy, all issues that defined the 2016 election. As part of our series, United and Divided, Harvest Public Media and Earth Eats want to bring you to a place dealing with all of those complex issues. A rural high school with a rapidly diversifying student body. Harvest's Luke Runyon has the story.
Also remember to stop.
It's first period at the high school in Fort Morgan, Colorado, and I've posted up at a desk in the back corner of a classroom.
Hey, U.S. states and capitals.
I came to Fort Morgan because it's a small rural city, just 11,000 people, and it's minority majority. Less than half the population here is white. At the high school, more than half of all students are Latino. And yet, the school is nestled in a farming county that voted overwhelmingly for President Donald Trump. English teacher Taylor Jordan moved to town a few years ago from suburban Denver.
From the highway and from the outside, it looks like just a typical small town, farm town. But then living here, just all the deep cultural roots that we have here, I think makes it such a special place.
Take this one class, ESL, English as a Second Language. Students hail from some of the world's most violent and war-torn countries: Somalia, Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras. The first student I meet is dressed in a floor-length plaid flannel dress and a light pink headscarf.
My name's Isra. I am senior this year, and I'm 18 years old.
Isra Mohamud is a Somali refugee. She's a member of the city's small but growing East African population. I ask her to describe Fort Morgan to someone who's never been here.
It smells kind of bad, to be honest, but it's good. I like it. We have this company called Cargill.
Cargill owns a meatpacking plant in town. The surrounding county is also home to a growing dairy industry. It has a big sugar processing factory. For decades, immigrants have flocked to jobs here, and they've kept the agriculture and manufacturing economy up and running. Mohammed arrived in the U.S. when she was in the eighth grade.
It was so difficult for me. I couldn't understand what people were saying. It was totally different culture, different people.
But that changed when she got to Fort Morgan High, amidst a diverse array of students. She still stands out around town, she says, but she's at home.
There is people who are going to stare at you because they never saw someone who's wearing hijab. And they're wondering what the hell's wrong with this person. But like most of people, like they don't even care. Like it's your culture, it's your thing.
Fort Morgan's cultural transformation has brought some tension. Muslims from Africa first arrived around 2007. And since then, police have responded to acts of vandalism. Religious disputes at the meatpacking plant flared up. Latino and Somali residents still say they sometimes get nasty looks when they speak a language other than English in public.
Community-wise, I think it was extremely difficult.
Ben Bauman is the high school's principal.
I think the community, there's some backlash of this other culture coming in, and not one or two, but hundreds.
There are formal efforts to integrate the various communities that call Fort Morgan home now, by the police, a nearby university, and a local nonprofit. But 16-year-old Kyla Carpenter says the high school is where the rubber often meets the road. To Carpenter, a Muslim refugee isn't an abstract idea. He's the person next to her in social studies. Undocumented students fleeing violence in Central America aren't just an image on the news. They're on the volleyball team.
Some of them try to, like, avoid the issue of this is happening because we go to school with people like this, and so we have to face it. We have to adapt to it.
Many parts of rural America are losing population. Fort Morgan has held steady or grown for years. Immigrants like Isra Mohammed made that happen.
People are always judging you, no matter how you are, no matter what you are, no matter your color. So you don't have to let them get you and let you down. You have to be strong and defend yourself.
Mohammed says she likes living here and wants to stay and work after she finishes high school. In Fort Morgan, Colorado, I'm Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
This is part of our occasional series, United and Divided. Find more reports like this at harvestpublicmedia.org. Luke and his fellow reporters do great work for us, thanks to them. So do Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, and Taylor Killo. A big thanks to our guy in the kitchen at Farm Bloomington, Daniel Orr. We work with Indiana University's Food Institute, and John Bailey is our executive producer. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses. Located on the Beeline Trail, more information at personalfinancialservices.net. Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From gluten-free to kosher and halal. Food for everyone, everywhere. Full menu and truck location available at urgentfoods.com. Alrighty, if you haven't yet, subscribe to our podcast so you can listen whenever you want. Thanks for being here. I'm Annie Corrigan.